Me too.
Okay, it is 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, June 13th. I'm Randy Crispin, Chairman of the Commission, joined by Commissioners Brian Krasius and Julie Fedorchak. This is an informal hearing on four NSP cases, numbers all starting with the letters PU and then 16-19, 18-112, 18-118, and 18-188. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Krasius, do you?
I do not.
Commissioner Fedorchak? Okay, so we'll go around the table, have everyone introduce themselves for the records. Please speak clearly into the microphone.
Mitch Wilkinson, Distribution Area Engineer, Xcel Energy.
Dave Cedarquist, Regulatory Affairs, Xcel Energy.
Victor Shook with staff.
John Hsu with staff.
And we have one person on the phone as well. John, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. John Ainscoff, Electric Distribution Performance, Xcel Energy.
Okay, thanks, John.
And Jerrilene just joined us.
And Jerrilene just joined us. So, who's going to be the lead spokesman? Dave, is that you? Okay. Go ahead and take it away.
So I have a question to start with. There's a number of dockets here that are included. I'm prepared to briefly provide an overview of all of them. I'm suspecting there's a little bit of a time constraint, so if you'd like, I can just focus on the reliability award piece, but I am prepared to talk about all of these if you'd like.
Can you go through them in a half hour?
I'll give it a shot, yeah. I'll give it a shot.
Maybe start with the reliability and then come back to the others.
Start with the reliability, except that all my slides are...
I know.
Okay, let's see if I can jump right to that.
Should get a bonus for winging it.
I have two of these. Did one of you not have one?
I don't have one.
One is for Julie.
Okay, well, you are probably aware we have been operating under a performance-based regulation that's focused on reliability since the year 2013. We've called the plan the Reliability Performance Plan, or RPP, since we don't do anything unless we can attach an acronym to it. 2017 was the fifth and the final year of the plan, and in 2017 we did achieve a goal of 43.7-minute system average interruption duration that exceeded a target or a threshold, an award threshold that was contemplated in the plan. So I'm here today to kind of describe how the RPP, or the Reliability Performance Plan, came to be. We'll talk about our performance under that plan, and then I'll finish up by talking about the proposal for recovery of the award. We go back to the years 2010 and 11. We filed a rate case in 2010. Just before that time, the company had really experienced a number of sort of unusual outage events. In 2010, we had a branch come into contact with conductor, and 21 customers in North Fargo had appliances and other electronic equipment damaged. Later on, in early 2011, we had a fire at a substation, and it destroyed some very expensive equipment. We call it an RTU unit, but 16,000 customers in Fargo were without power for a while. So we had a few really unusual reliability events. In addition to having many meetings with customers and some city officials, we had a number of meetings as well with the commission and staff to discuss those outages and what our plans were to remedy them. In a subsequent work session held later in the rate case proceeding, the commission at the time did suggest that the parties consider filing a performance-based plan focused on reliability. The final settlement agreement that we reached with staff in that rate case included a provision directing the company to develop and file a reliability performance plan within 90 days. There was some direction provided in the rate case settlement. For example, the industry standard indicators such as SAFE, CAIDI, and SAIDI were to be considered along with some other metrics that related to customer experience. We're given some direction to have incentives that were symmetrical, in other words, both carrots and sticks, I guess. So we did file a plan in, I believe it was June of 2012. The plan really complemented some of the reliability initiatives and reporting commitments that were built already into the rate case settlement agreement. So we ended up with a trio of metrics, I'll say, and one thing that staff kind of kept pushing us on was to keep this plan kind of simple and basic. Don't get too fancy, don't get too sophisticated. So we kept it to just three major components. First of all, we established what we called an excellence threshold and a reward or an award for outstanding outage duration performance as measured by the SAIDI index. We also came up with a compensation to customers who had experienced multiple outages defined as more than three in a given year. And then we also had some reporting requirements around our reliability survey results. You can see on the table there that, and I'll walk through these a little bit, we actually created an excellence threshold of 57 minutes. We did this by looking back at history, and then we overlaid some of the history with the improvements that we expected with the installation of our automated IntelliTeam. So, in other words, staff was saying, well, look, you're going to be doing all these things in the future. We need to take down bring down your threshold because that stuff was going to help. So we did that. And then we took, we cut 15% out of that historical average and called that our excellence threshold. So 57 minutes had never been achieved in the recent history, so that became our measure. And we established an award range, actually, kind of a sliding range in a way. If the company was to achieve the 57 minutes, there would be a base level award of $250,000 regardless of what our earnings were. But if we were under-earning in that same year, then we could supplement the $250,000 with the revenue deficiency, with the whole award being capped at $1.5 million. It could never be higher than that. So the results were to be normalized to exclude severe storms and other unusual circumstances, and the plan called for using the IEEE standard 1366 normalization methodology in order to determine that. I can talk a little bit about that. The IEEE standard 1366 kind of came out of a need, really, if you go back to the 80s and 90s when computers were really coming into play and computerized automation and all that, customer needs became more and more sophisticated. Utilities were looking for a way to sort of go to the next level in terms of reliability, and that required lots of measurement. At the same time, regulators were looking for ways to, hold utilities accountable and measure electric service reliability. So there was this push to establish some metrics that could be used both internally and externally for goal setting, for measuring progress, and quite frankly, for benchmarking, for making comparative analysis between different utilities. But always the major obstacle was the lack of a uniform method for determining how you determine what an unusual or abnormal outage event was, and that's the whole normalization process. But in 2004, the IEEE, the Institute of Electric and Electronic Engineers, developed a standard called Standard 1366 for identifying. It was a statistical approach, so very subjective, for identifying some of these abnormal or outlying types of outages. They later became referred to as major event days, and were defined using statistics. Going back into history, determining what the reliability profile was for you, and then determining whether on any given day the outage experience on that day was outside of a statistical bandwidth there. So what the IEEE standard did was it produced then a normalization method that would be applicable to all utility sizes and the amounts of reliability data. It allowed utilities to clearly segment reliability data into sort of the normal and the abnormal. And it also facilitated use of these reliability indices. You could now normalize these, and there would be some uniformity so that utilities would be reporting pretty fair and consistent results. Going on, I'll say that in 2017, we did have two major event days, or MEDs as they're called. June 13 was kind of your more typical storm-related type of major event day with lots of high winds, rain, and lightning. There were actually 43 different outages recorded in the Fargo and Grand Forks areas. Over 2 million customer minutes out were recorded. That was almost three times the major event day threshold for North Dakota, so that was clearly an abnormal event. December 17th, a little bit different situation there. Thick fog and wet conditions during the wintertime here in December. Kind of perfect sort of conditions for the phenomenon that produces pole fires. So the other thing that sort of led to that situation was the location of this infrastructure right on Main Avenue and I-29, which are high traffic arterial roadways where there's a lot of traffic kicking up a lot of melting materials that are on the road. So the conditions, it was a perfect storm for this kind of a situation. But what really set it apart was the extensive damage that resulted from the fire. This was a structure that actually held two different feeders, so the pole fire created a lot of damage and affected a lot of people there. The customer minutes out were about 1.4 million minutes, and that was almost twice what the MED threshold was for North Dakota. This chart does just sort of show you a 10-year history of our SAIDI results. From 2013 and on, that was during the reliability plan. The dotted blue line that you see there is a trend line indicating improvement over time. The red line is the RPP threshold, award threshold, and you can see that in 2017 was the first time, although we did come close in 2014. This chart I wanted to throw in because it does show we know we can compare within our own company the different SAIDI results by state, and you can see here that our reliability in North Dakota is really pretty solid. This is a five-year average of the SAIDI. It's not just looking at a single year because there is variability, but if you look over the past five years, North Dakota customers are experiencing on average about an hour that they're without power during the year. Now, what we did note in 2017 is a continued reduction in underground cable faults, and this is kind of a big deal. Underground cable faults is typically the biggest cause of outages year in and year out. We're really seeing some progress here. As you know, we had embarked on a three-year program to remove some real troubling underground cable that we've had, and Mitch can probably speak to it more, but we're on the sort of the tail end of that project, continuing to remove our 500 MCM cable. So we believe that that's having an effect. This chart here shows the top 10 outage causes in 2017. You can see, again, underground cable being the number one cause. And so that's why we're working hard to control that.
Does unknown mean you never do figure it out? It just
unknown means that it has, in fact, been looked into, and we've had crews trying to figure it out. But, yeah, they couldn't come to any definitive explanation for the outage. Let's see. So let me shift a little bit and talk about the funding of the award, that the $250,000 award. We had originally in March sent the commission a letter, and well, let me back up even more. In the original RPP plan filing, we contemplated that if there was a need for recovery of an award, the surcharge would be applied probably in the fuel cost rider, and it would be done in a shoulder month where there's not a lot of energy use, like September or October. Well, in this March, when it looked like we were going to actually have an award based on the 2017 data, and we thought it was going to be fairly sizable too, like $1.5 million, we proposed that that $1.5 million award actually be amortized over 2 years, $750,000 recovery in each year, but then offset or netted with the DOE refund payment, which we believed would be in that same ballpark as far as magnitude. So we thought at most we might have just a small true-up that we could throw into the fuel cost rider in 2019. And essentially, we would avoid having to put a billing credit out there and go to all the work of doing that.
I looked at the DOE payments, but now I'm trying to recall. They haven't been terribly consistent, have they?
Well, they tend to be in that $800,000 to $1 million range. But, yes, we have had a few outliers there that are more. So we knew the eighth payment that we would net was $788,000, and the ninth payment, we were just sort of banking that it would be in that same range. So
you'd have a balance, so to speak, of $712,000.
Yeah.
Well, a little less.
Possibly.
Just under $712,000.
Right.
And then payment number nine from the DOE would...
If it was $800,000, we might end up with a $100,000 credit that we would then true up through the fuel cost rider or some method like that. That would be really easy to do.
And part of why the DOE payments look so... all over the place is because that first one was so high because it was for like 8 or 10 years, right?
Yeah, the initial payments covered damages for multiple years, and lately they've been covering damages for a single year for the most part. So now they're starting to sort of be more predictable, I guess. Let's see, I was going to... So that's what happened in March. Now, last week... I'm sorry, Commissioner.
I'm debating whether to do this now or when you're done going through the funding, but I wanted to go back to, at some point, the MED process and identifying those 2 days. Do you want to get through the funding first and come back to that, or what would be the best?
Maybe I will just finish the funding piece, and then
let's
go back and take a closer look at that. I only really had one slide left, and that was to just say that last week we filed another proposal. We've learned that the reliability award is not $1.5 million. It's only $250,000. The reason for that is because our 2017 earnings was not deficient. It was it exceeded the authorized level. Kind of came as a surprise to us. And so that whole plan to amortize over 2 years and net against the two credits kind of doesn't make sense.
So that, I think, answers my question. On the June 7th filing, it showed the reliability award recovery of $250,000, and yet when I'm looking at these numbers, it was based on $1.5 million. And
right. We were trying to not surprise the commission. We wanted you to know well in advance how big the reliability award could be. We had literally 6 or 7 continuous years of under-earnings on our electric business. In the state of North Dakota, we did not see that we would be over-earning. But we did in 2017, and we've attributed that mainly to the fact that our demand allocator in 2017, which is a pretty big driver of production and transmission expenses, had dropped fairly significantly in 2017. And so a lot of expense that we might normally see in North Dakota went away.
So the DOE nuclear fuel payment then, in effect, isn't offsetting the 1.5?
Right. The DOE payments 8 and 9 are going to far exceed the reliability piece.
Right. Okay.
So that spawned kind of a new idea here, is since we had over-earned and in a previous settlement committed to refunding any over-earnings to customers in 2017, that amounts almost $3 million for that earnings sharing provision. Why don't we take that and the eighth payment here that we know is $788,000. There's going to be some interest as well, maybe $5,000 or $6,000 added onto that. We know we have this $128,000 gain that is part of our asset sale at our Inverhills plant. That's a different filing. Why don't we take all those and package them all up with the reliability award recovery charge, and we would eliminate, you know, the need to increase bills for the reliability piece. We would actually eliminate all the other individual refunds by doing it just one time. It would avoid the need for an FCR true-up credit. We could just kind of take care of this thing with one fell swoop.
So then the 250 comes off of the 3.9, netting out at
3.6. Yeah, we're looking at about a $3.6 million net credit for customers. So I guess.
And how does the credit get applied?
The credit would be applied in the same manner that we would normally do a single DOE credit. We would apply it to a one-time charge on the customer bill. It'd be a separate line item, only now, of course, the message would be a little more expanded. It would describe the credit as being related to more than this one item.
So one-time credit,
bigger credit. Instead of being the 788, it's 3.6 million.
Do you have a ballpark on?
I think for the typical residential customer, it's between $16 and $17.
Okay.
The one-time charge. So I was just going to conclude by saying that, you know, what we're really looking for is acknowledgement of the $250,000 award that kind of closes out the RPP. There's nothing that we've agreed to extend that plan. And then approval of this RPP award recovery alongside the other $3.9 million. That's kind of where we're going. We did file yesterday more specific data showing how the $3.6 million net would be allocated to the different classes and what the impact would be, the bill impact. So that just came in to you guys yesterday. So now we'll go back to our med.
Well, did staff have any more questions on that topic?
Lots of them.
Oh.
Okay. So actually,
are you going to the med too?
Yeah. I mean,
I wasn't talking. Well, I'm talking on what, on the numbers. In terms of
nothing on those numbers, but okay. Lot on them. So we're covering a lot of cases here. Some of them that we haven't really fully reviewed. I think we kind of kept adding cases to this informal as the time went on. So there's a couple of them I'm prepared to ask some questions and talk about. But if you guys would like to ask your questions first, I'm completely fine with that.
We'll have Commissioner Fedorchak
first. So on the determining of the MED or MED. It seems like there's some subjectivity in there. Am I wrong? Like, I see all this that's been outlined in terms of the IEEE standard, but what's the formula for determining whether something is? And I'm just trying to think, like, if I'm explaining this to a ratepayer, and they hear, okay, so they had pole fires on their, you know, distribution pole, and that caused outages, but they don't have to take responsibility for that? And I just don't think that's an easy explanation. So
sure.
Help me understand how that's
okay.
Determinations made.
I might leave most of that to John to comment on, but I will just say, generally speaking, the establishment of this uniform method, you know, that's not easy to do. There has to be a little bit of, I guess, It's not going to be a perfect process for determining normalized outages, but it is highly mathematical and subjective from the standpoint that, again, we look at history to develop sort of an acceptable range, and that history keeps moving right along with time, so it's like a rolling history. And then we use a log normal distribution, which is, again, a statistical approach to determining what normal experience is. And so if you have, and it's listed in terms of the impact on SAIDI, so if you have a med threshold of, say, an event that will increase your SAIDI score 8 minutes or more, that is the med for North Dakota, then you've got a very clear-cut line or threshold for when a day exceeds that med. So both of these were like, you know, one was $2 million, one was $1.5 million of minutes out, and they far exceeded. The June 13th outage created a 15-minute addition to the SAIDI score for the year. So,
so the theory on this is the reliability. So if there's big things mm-hmm. that happen that cause outages that are significant, mm-hmm. those shouldn't be counted.
Right, because they really create a lot of variance in your measurement, in your measuring of reliability. It becomes very difficult to look ahead and plan and set a goal if you're going to just include some of these far outlying, rare, or uncontrollable, quite frankly, in some cases. If you're going to include everything, yeah, it creates a lot of variability.
But the more routine daily operations, that's what the goal of the performance plan was to address.
Kind
to
of.
Avoid those small, annoying, frequent.
Right. To focus on reliability where this. That is within the system's sort of design and operational limits is what we really want to measure with our normalized. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that the abnormal events aren't reviewed and looked at. I mean, a company is going to review those too, but it's going to probably end up taking a different path to avoid those if they take a path at all. Some of them are clearly going to just be outside the, you know, if it's a tornado or something, I don't know what a utility would
right.
do. But
the coal fires are kind of avoidable.
That's, yes.
That's my struggle
right.
with this one, is it's the coal fire, which we've identified as something that could be fixed or done away with.
Right. Altogether. There definitely are things that we're able to do to minimize the occurrence of coal fires. But again, I think the 1366 is going to take a look at an outage event that is so extreme, and it might not be a non-control. It might be a controllable event to a degree, but it's such an impactful event that it qualifies as an abnormal event. In this case, the situation was we had a double circuited pole with two feeders on it, serving I don't know 6,000 plus customers. It was a big. The damage was tremendous, so you don't just send a two-man crew out there and they're going to fix it. It requires there's a lot of switching. There's a more sophisticated protocol for how you reroute the power and do it safely. We needed more crews. We ended up even having a crew come down from Grand Forks. So it's the unusual aspect of the outage that qualifies it as the type of outage that we would want to normalize out. John, do you have anything that you'd like to add to that or
yes,
speak
like
to the calculation of the threshold?
Yes, I would like to elaborate and clarify just a little bit. One thing, not to criticize your word choice, but you got a little mixed up. You called this a subjective method. It's actually an objective method.
Oh, yes, thank you.
There's no discretion there. Let me briefly explain. The IEEE method describes days into what we call major event days, I guess, and non-major event days. And that is purely a mathematical calculation. It doesn't matter what cause occurred to outages on that day. To answer the commissioner's question, the basic procedure or calculation is based on is looking at daily SAIDI, the SAIDI number for each day of the year, and then statistical calculation methods that goes into the log normal and the normal and the, all those fine details. But basically what it does is identifies the extreme outliers. So if it was these distributions were perfect, typically it would be maybe 2 or 3 days a year would qualify for major event day. And again, it's not related to what caused that to have that high level of customer minutes out. It's just that that occurred. And the purpose, as he summarized earlier, was to promote a better segmentation of data, the occurrences that happen on those major event days. That's not information that's thrown away or ignored, but is looked at separately. And we also take into account what happens on those days as we evaluate our system and plan for reliability improvements. But it allows us to also kind of segment out what is more the normal type days so that it provides a little bit more steadiness and that we can see trends over time. I may have wandered a little bit there. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did, and thank you for that. I still struggle with how you explain this to customers, and I'm sure you guys have to do that yourselves. Because I'm thinking from a customer standpoint, they think, why do you get to throw out any days when it comes to reliability? Why doesn't it all count?
I will say, Commissioner, that the establishment of the award threshold, the SAIDI award threshold, also reflected the throwing out or the elimination of abnormal days. So, you know, that threshold might have been justifiably higher had we included all outages in the past. So it just makes the measurement more reliable because you're only dealing with the normalized outages.
I
hope that makes sense, but...
Or more predictable.
More predictable.
Okay, so I have to ask this question. If the measurement process is so objective, how on March 7th could it be calculated at 1.5 million if it's that precise? And then on June 7th, it's at 250,000.
Yes, Commissioner.
How did that move around so
right,
much?
That discrepancy only has to do with our earnings for the year because the 250,000 is your base level award, and the only way you get to 1.5 million is if you're under earning. The plan says that you can add that to your award and up until $1.5 million. So it really doesn't have anything to do with the reliability result.
So the result didn't change. It was the earnings came in. And
right. It was the award calculation.
Okay. Victor?
Okay. So, med days. I want to talk a little bit about the settlement agreement that kind of led to this whole thing. So I have the entire thing here in front of me. So the whole 250,000 versus 1.5 million, it is spelled out in here pretty well. The lower end, if they achieve the SAIDI goal, the minimum is 250,000 if they are meeting or exceeding their earnings. And if they are under earning, then the reward level could be up to 1.5 million. So that's kind of that discrepancy. And okay. I agree with what Dave was saying, that it wasn't really anything shady on their part. It was just kind of, you know, at the time, and I would have agreed at the time too. It looked like they were probably going to under-earn for the year, and lo and behold, we over-earned. So that's a positive note. Now, the 57-minute goal, SAIDI goal, there was a lot of discussion. So I wasn't here at the time this settlement agreement was signed, but I read a whole lot of stuff, and I learned about SAIDI and Katie and way more than I ever wanted to know. But the company is correct. It is objective. And this is a statistical calculation. I have the the formula here and the definition of it. I thought it was interesting. Major event designates a catastrophic event which exceeds reasonable design or operation limits of the electric power system and during which at least 10% of the customers within an operating area experience a sustained interruption during a 24-hour period. This is from that IEEE 1366 standard. I think
that's from an older version.
That's what I was going to say. This was from 98, so that definition may have changed. I couldn't find the most recent one. In any case, I think the general idea that what I've found is a major event day should be a day where the system was taken beyond its design limitations. So that's kind of the underlying principle from my perspective. So with that being said, so the med days get excluded. And I think we could pretty easily say if there's two days being excluded from 2017, the one is the storm day where we had 43 separate outages, and the other is this December 17th pole fire. In my investigation on this case, you know, I requested a lot of data from the company, and we can provide this to you. But an event day, for example, or a day that would be excluded as a med event day, has a lot of stuff going on. So this is the detail for one day in 2014 that was excluded during for that calculation. This is the page for the December day in 2017. So it looks very different because there's not as much going on. This is a whole bunch of unique individual outages that happened because of stormy weather or something along those lines. And this, in reality, is really two things. One is the pole fire, and one is another very minor thing that doesn't really, there was a overhead line issue that really didn't contribute to anything. It was the pole fire, and it was one single pole fire that took out, I believe it was two separate feeders, and caused this major outage. Now, it is a med day as defined and calculated. However, in the settlement agreement, one of the provisions we agree to, while the parties agree that the IEEE normalization methodology will be used to calculate SAIDI under the RPP, the company and advocacy staff agree to discuss in good faith the appropriateness of excluding any outage day questioned or contested by staff. And that's where we get to this questioning of the pole fire in particular. and I think that's really a question we need to answer is it appropriate to remove a pole fire in this calculation? And I guess I don't have the answer. I think it is questionable. You know, that's one thing. I mean, I wasn't around when this was signed. I don't recall all of the details of that, but I do recall since I've been here, there's been a lot of discussion about pole fires, how to prevent them. And I recall there was a lot of discussion about concentrating on ones that are in higher traffic areas because those receive more of the salt spray, which I think contributes to the pole fire happening. And this was, in fact, a pole fire in a high traffic area. So it's worth questioning.
And it has been a question for me as I read through this initially and again for today that I just think it's hard to justify for customers that that is outside of what is reasonably expected for the company to try to mitigate and avoid.
Sure, and I've been becoming a more and more of a pole fire expert myself, and it's actually a lot of analysis. And the one question that you ask yourself is it going to get high enough to get up there? And that's the hard question that you try to answer when you're doing these proactive projects. The one way that you know is when you're being reactive, when you've seen a pole fire there, and you know that it's gone 80 feet from the roadway and 45 feet up. And from that data, you can develop plans where you see that again and again. The problem with this spot is there had never been a pole fire there. The poles were higher than where a pole fire has happened in other parts, where there's been, when you have something on the east side of the interstate, well, if you actually look at the wind rows for our part of the country, it's north, northwest, and north, northwest. That's where our spray is. So when you're looking at those angles, you're primarily focusing on the south and southwest parts of the road. So this had never had a pole fire in that area, and it happened.
It still is hard to predict without some type of data that tells you that that contamination is getting up there.
Have you guys looked at the locations where you have poles that would be susceptible to pole fires and the impact of the fire should that pole have one? So, like, in this case, there's a huge impact because of the multiple feeders on that pole. Was that part of your calculation when you started to take some steps to mitigate these issues?
The initial impact was looking at the places where we think there's going to be a pole fire. The likelihood was the first one. We wanted to eliminate the ones that were most likely first and then move on to higher risk areas that may or may not have a pole fire.
And the fix is?
The fix for these locations is to replace any wood arms with fiberglass cross arms and replace normal insulators with contamination style. The insulators that we use are a higher voltage level. It gives it a little bit taller gap in order to mitigate the chance of current leakage across those arms.
Is that a costly fix?
Relatively inexpensive. I mean, when you're talking compared to undergrounding something or mm-hmm. Other means of getting it out of the contamination zone, yeah, it's inexpensive. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Victor, looks like you're back up.
I think that's all I have on the liability performance bonus. I think it's worth considering that whether or not it's appropriate to exclude that one med day. The other day that they're excluding, I would agree with. That's kind of a storm day that kind of meets that criteria of taking the system beyond its design limitations. But mm-hmm. when it's a single event and an event caused by something that we've had issues with and had a lot of discussion about in the past, it's questionable. Mm-hmm. Is my thought.
So that if that pole fire was excluded, that would push the score above the threshold, correct?
I believe so.
Yeah, I believe I'm trying to think if it was, yeah, without that, we were looking at 60 to 61 minutes, somewhere in that range for a Sadie.
I mean, I really appreciate the improvements that the company's had and the investment that's been made and the effort to reduce the outages. I think it's a real positive and you know, we entered into the agreement in good faith, even though none of us signed it. And the goal was to have improvements. So I think we need to pay attention to that, but in my opinion, I guess it just doesn't seem like that pole fire is an MED, and the fix isn't that expensive. We talked about those fixes. You were doing them. This is an area that, you know, was obviously has a significant impact if there is a fire. So for not a lot of money, I would think the company would be looking at those specific things too, as in terms of, well, where do we really not want to have one, and let's make sure we fix those as well as the ones that are the most likely to happen. So
it looks like there are a couple questions here, and this is just something I'm going to float, and of course Victor and I both haven't had a chance to actually work through all these things, and there were, like you said, a number of filings that came in and added to the informal list a little bit faster than we realized. But this is a question, I guess, for Dave, and I know this may be something you have to run back up and discuss, but with the $250,000, would the company be, I guess, interested in the possibility that $250,000 being earmarked for reliability, improvements to the system reliability as part of just some sort of agreement if there are concerns?
Sure, yeah, no, that's definitely an idea that we'd be amenable to, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Discuss. And the other thing I just wanted to run by you, since I was just kind of passing through the discussion on the fuel cost adjustment rider, the filing in 18. Oh, what number is that off top?
118.
Yes, 18118. And you guys are requesting a variance to run the one-time or bill credit through the fuel the automatic adjustment clause. And I was just wondering if we could just, for the record, have a statement of why do you think that there's good cause to have a deviation from the automatic adjustment clause?
With smaller, I think we're talking about the $128,000, with smaller items, it becomes a little bit more difficult to do a single bill line credit on the bill. You're talking some pretty small factors to make that happen, and the refunds, you know, might be 9 cents or something like that. So for some of the smaller ones, and there's a lot of work that goes into setting up a line item credit on a bill, more than you'd want to know. So sometimes for some of those smaller adjustments like that, it just makes sense administratively to include it in the fuel clause adjustment. So that's the primary reason. The reason why we would now suggest maybe putting it in with the others is that if you're already doing a credit anyway, it doesn't matter how many different elements of that credit there are, because you're going through the work anyway. So
makes sense.
I will just also remind the commission that, and I don't know if you'll get questions on this, but part of the plan, too, has been the $50 credits to customers. The company has refunded customers or awarded customers $450,000 over the last 5 years for those credits. I'm not sure that customers will be calling or expecting them, but right now those also drop off as part of this plan as well. So I just wanted to make sure you were aware of that.
Do you know, Dave, how much was given in $50 credits for the year 2017?
Yeah, it was actually a lesser year, as you might expect. It was about $31,000. Let me just double check to make sure here. Yeah, $31,600. When we file our annual earnings report each year, it's in the back. The entire RPP plan results are listed there. So it was a pretty light year, actually.
David, this is for information that I'm just a little bit interested in, because when I read through the filing on the PU18-118, the jurisdictional gain is $218,000, and $128,000 is what the company is suggesting that will be passed directly back to the customers. The company will retain the $90,000, and then and the basis for that is that we can expect cost reductions that the customers would have seen of net present value of $91,000?
Not quite. The numbers are coincidentally close. The $90,000 that the company is proposing to retain is equivalent to the return on the assets that the company would have received. It's a net present value of all the returns for the remaining life of that asset. So the thinking is that the company would be sort of financially neutral and not be disadvantaged by selling the asset. The $91,000 that you're referring to is kind of another little benefit, ultimate benefit for customers. Besides the $128,000 gain that they would get back as a credit, all of the depreciation and O&M expense related to that asset those assets for the next 10 years would be gone. And ultimately, that would, affect rates, lower rates. So that $91,000 kind of, I think in our filing, we did say that you could add that to the $128,000, and the ultimate benefit for customers is about $219,000.
So coincidental but unrelated.
Yeah, very much so.
So one last quick one for me, on the DOE. Credit?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a DOE credit, and I'm just trying to verify that, but I believe that was at 5.3% in terms of the allocation to North Dakota customers. The fuel clause adjustment was at 5.19%, so there's a discrepancy. Is that because of different years going back to when the settlement or the credit from the DOE was calculated versus present?
I think it probably has more to do with the allocation factor being a little different. One is probably more demand-oriented, and one's more energy-related. The fuel cost rider is an energy-driven calculation. When we were allocating the nuclear fuel, we're allocating it based on the nuclear plant investment, which is going to be more driven by, or at least partly driven by, the demand allocator. There is somewhat of a difference. So if you took the $15 million that we got from the DOE and you allocated 15% to Wisconsin and 85% to Minnesota, and then you took 6% of Minnesota, which is our basic demand allocator, you'd end up with a number close to the $788,000. It's a pretty simple formula. And it is detailed in our filing that we filed in December of last year when we initially filed for the DOE credit. By the way, just so you're aware, the eighth payment, we were proposing the exact same methodology that was used for the sixth and the seventh payment. We're kind of now in a zone where we've figured it all out, you know, and we're going to do the one-time billing thing. So we're not changing anything, although, like I said, last week we said, hey, instead of doing it in isolation, let's put it all together in a package of refunds and do it together. So,
is there any one or two major things that you would mostly attribute your projections being pretty far off as far as your earnings? You said last year you were still thought you'd be under, and now you're $3 million over.
I'm going to show you a slide here that I had prepared just in case questions came up that way. Here's our earnings results. You know, since 2010, we've never earned the authorized return. So that was our thinking, that the reliability award would be $1.5 million, because we had really no idea that our earnings would pop above the authorized, so which they did in 2017. This is a trend that shows our demand allocator. Like I said, this is a pretty important allocator for our production and transmission system costs. There's a lot of dollars there, and small deviations in that demand allocator can have a big impact on a smaller part of our business. North Dakota is, you know, small, 6%.
Tell us what the demand allocator is.
Okay. Yep. The demand allocator is the portion of North Dakota load that contributes to our entire NSP system peak each month. So it varies each month. Some months it might be 4%, some months it might be 7%, but we average it out for the whole year and we come up with an average for the year.
Give me the definition again.
It's the North Dakota load's contribution to the system peak.
Okay, each month.
Each month.
Okay.
And what we have seen...
And this is the average of the 12 months.
Yeah, more or less. It's called it's a 12 CP, so we take all 12 months and average them. But you can see that over time, the dotted line is sort of a trend. Most of the time, the demand allocator shown by the purple line is within a reasonable distance from that trend line. But you can see in 2014 and 15, it started to deviate on the high side. We were seeing percentages in the 6.3 to 6.4 range, and we were just thinking that given the trend from 2012 and 2013 and 14 and 15, that's just was a trend, that North Dakota was contributing more to the peak and we were going to be seeing this. Some were suggesting maybe it has to do with the fact that demand-side management efforts are more robust in Minnesota and South Dakota, and this is the result of that. Well,
or that our economy is stronger.
Exactly.
Than you anticipate.
Exactly.
Could be a more positive way to see that.
Yeah. That does sound better.
I'm not surprised that didn't occur to the folks in Minneapolis.
Although electric growth in North Dakota is still pretty, for us, it's pretty anemic. I mean, it's like 0.5% a year. So.
Okay.
But in 2016, we saw kind of a drop. And then in 2017, to our surprise, it really dropped. And so we are taking a really hard look. I mean, not only trying to understand why this could make sense, but also going back and auditing our metering equipment at the state borders and all that to find out what could be going on or why we can't get our arms around this and make this a little more predictable. But that's really what's going on here. I will also add that for the third year in a row, NSP actually reduced its O&M company-wide. It's sort of unusual, but it actually went down in real terms. So that also, that helps earnings because we get an allocation of O&M costs, too, throughout the production and transmission functions. So, you know, there were some things like that, too, that also figured in, but we're looking mainly at the demand allocator change.
How are your earnings in Minnesota? Are you
They're right around the authorized, 9.3, 9.4. I think they're authorized at 9.2 something in Minnesota. So they're pretty good. But the difference there is you can have a demand allocator change like this and it will hardly budge earnings, the return on equity in Minnesota. It's that big, you know, that a change from 6.3 to 5.9 that's nothing. Whereas in North Dakota, every time you go down a tenth, it changes the revenue requirement $1.5 million. So it makes for a big change.
So I'm just kind of thinking some numbers here, because that's what I do. So 10.4 was the authorized last return in North Dakota. If we were, let's say, 9.4, even higher than what you were authorized in Minnesota, that would be like $15 million difference.
Yeah, it was 10.25 is the authorized and currently in North Dakota.
Sure.
So, yeah, a whole 100 basis points is about $4.6 million from an ROE perspective now.
Right, right.
So that would add $4.6 million if I understand your question.
Yeah, no, that's kind of where I was going.
That was
going to be another question, I guess, tax reform. I know we haven't really formalized anything there, but there's some initial estimates, I think, were in the $10 to $15 million range for savings on that as well.
In the February filing that we submitted, there were some preliminary numbers there in that range. We have prepared a letter to send to the commission to let them know kind of where we're at with the TCGA analysis. It's been drafted. We're just holding off for a little bit, but you can expect a letter on that.
For long?
So for the not too long, maybe within the week.
But you're not suggesting merging that with this?
I don't think so, because it's going to take a while for the TCGA discussion to finally land somewhere, and we're assuming that the commission wants to get these things out the door as soon as possible. So
sure.
I don't think so. I mean, maybe it would have been nice if they'd have coincided a little better, but.
Pat?
Sure. I'm sort of related to procedurally, there's one thing that we haven't done here, and that is the most recent filing on the over-earnings that you wanted to share with customers. That's the only piece of this that we haven't issued a notice of opportunity for hearing on. And so we would need to do that before the decision about the bundle.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We've been doing notices on all of these.
I think it does. It would. Someone may challenge the numbers thinking they should be greater.
Maybe someone will oppose the refund. And
someone, it's...
or they might think it wasn't enough.
I don't think it's enough.
I'm well.
I guess the other thing was that we could have our weights and measures come out and oversee the testing of your meters on your demand.
Well, a lot of scrubbing has already occurred, and so far we're coming up that they're working fine.
Yeah.
Seems like they're working fine.
I don't know. I mean, that is the question.
Or a slower rate of growth compared to other geographies.
Any other questions?
Just one question, and I'm not going to get too deep into this. It's just general question from the statement you just made about the TCGA. Will we be anticipating two different filings for NSP Gas and one for electric just with individual filings?
We are, the letter that we've prepared addresses them separately, but it's one letter. Because we do see completely different applications possibly between the electric and the gas side on the potential savings there. So
the TCJA.
Yeah, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, yeah.
Anything else?
Well, I guess the thing that might be a little bit different about TCJA as far as choosing, or TCJA as far as bundling it with these, would be that may be more, that may end up in a rate reduction, monthly rate reduction, and these are one-time offset credits.
Right, right. That's a good point. Is there any objection to the information we've gathered today, both the written and the oral, being made a part of the case and used for making a decision on these cases?
No.
Okay. Seeing no or hearing no objection, the information that we have gathered, both the written and the oral, will be made a part of the record for the basis of a decision. Anything else? We're concluded. Thank you, everyone.